Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Today is the full moon day. We are now 2 months into the rains retreat this year. One more month left to run before the rains retreat. The Vasa is completed. And customarily, and according to our training during this time, we try to minimize our travels outside of the monastery. But if there's a particular special reason or cause, then we can accept invitations to go to some place or another. And during this rains, as it was my 60th birthday a couple of weeks ago, I accepted the invite from my sisters to go to spend a week in the south of France, in the region near the foothills of the Pyrenees. And the reason why they chose that area was there was a childhood friend of mine. His birthday is also very close. It was on the 7th of September, and we went to kindergarten, primary school, and high school together, secondary school, and were good friends throughout that time. And the last time we saw each other was at my 21st birthday party in 1977. So we had a bit of catching up to do. And he was a farmer in Kent, and had sold up and moved to France about 12 years ago. And he'd got in touch with me a few years back, and had been exchanging a few messages, a few emails, and so we thought it would be a good way to celebrate our mutual 60ths and to meet up again, spend a bit of time together, and catch up on what we've been up to the last 40 years. That region of France, in the area of near Carcassonne and the sort of southeastern corner of France, was back in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. It was a center of what was what's called the Cathar Christianity, the Cathar movement. And that the memories, the resonances of that that movement and its suppression are very strong within the landscape. I picked up a little bit of the history while I was there, since it was so heavily represented in the ancient towns and cities, castles around that region. And it was a very strong cause for reflection, because this particular Christian group, the Cathars, it seems to have been a particular strand of Christianity that came out of the Middle East around about the 10th century into northern Italy and France and the Mediterranean region, and had steadily gathered strength. And then in 1209, the interestingly named Pope Innocent III declared a crusade against the Cathars to destroy them, to wipe out their communities, or wipe out their views. So it was a very strong cause for reflection about religion and religious tolerance and intolerance. And because those stories and the places that where the Cathar communities lived were still very much in evidence, right, in that region, very close to where we were staying, that we were in a little village called Belker, in the Salt Valley. Was close to Montségur, which is the last stronghold of the Cathars in, I think if I can remember my dates, it's something like 1246. So that was where the Cathar community ended. The last holdout, 220 of them were hiding out from the Pope's army, and they laid siege to them. They were besieged for 10 months, and the Montségur is this little castle right on top of a very, very steep pinnacle of rock. So it's very, very difficult to climb from either side. And then finally they broke the siege by having some sort of commando types climb up ropes up the sort of vertical cliff, the side they thought nobody could get in. And some people did managed to climb up that side. They broke in. They ended the siege, and so then the Cathars had to surrender. They had a number of views that the Catholic Church of the time objected to. They believed in reincarnation. This is what I'm remembering from the history books. They believed in reincarnation, and they were vegetarian, and they also had a very dualistic perception of good and evil, and they didn't respect the priesthood in the same way that the Catholic authorities did. They had what they called the parfait, the perfect ones, who were a sort of quasi-monastic order of women and men, and undertook a kind of renunciant lifestyle of great simplicity. And so they also were critical of all the richness of the church at that time, the Catholic orthodoxy that liked to have lots of gold and jewelry and grand robes and such like. So they objected to that grandeur of the Catholic Church and their and the kind of richness that the bishops and priests and the abbots displayed. So after they broke the siege, they gave the 220 Cathars an ultimatum. So you can either renounce your faith as Cathars and join the kind of quote-unquote proper church, or you can be burnt alive on a bonfire. And they apparently, with great quietness and grace, they just all walked down the mountain and onto the fire. And 220 of them were burnt alive. And that was the end of the Cathar movement. It was very, very sort of heartbreaking and touching, actually, being in this place a week ago today, Friday of last week. I think I was... I climbed Montségur with my family and this old friend of mine into this castle, and being in that place and looking down at the view around and looking at the place where all of the people were burned alive, touches the heart, how our religious views can be so strong people can be persecuted so heavily. And it's also striking how this kind of intolerance is also not a thing of the past, but even today people will be so strong or so sure of their religious rightness that they take it upon themselves to take the lives of others in defense of their ideas of purity or rightness or goodness, or the defense of their particular version of religious truth. this is painful to be in the presence of today and to see the kind of destruction that is caused, and also how, you know, it was the case for so many people back then in the 13th century. But also in that region, it wasn't the worst of the massacres. That was the final one, but earlier on, even more sort of gut wrenching. Was the, not that this evening I want to make a whole history lesson, but these are important pieces of history to reflect upon. The city of Béziers was besieged earlier on. This is earlier in that crusade. The city of Béziers was besieged by the Pope's army. And the army was being led by the abbot of Citeaux Monastery. I forget his name. The abbot was the head of the army, and the people of Béziers began besieged, and they surrendered. And then the general came up to the abbot and said, "The city has surrendered, but yet we know that some of them are faithful, they're true Catholics, and some of them are." These heretics, the Cathars, but the faithful will not turn over to us the heretics, so that the faithful Catholics were not betraying who the Cathars were. They were sort of protecting them, if you like, and so we don't know how to tell them apart. We don't know who are the people who are sort of law-abiding Catholics and who are the members of this heretical sect. We don't know how to tell them apart. What should we do? And then the abbot to in my opinion, to his great discredit and most painfully, said, "Kill them all. The Lord will recognize his own." 20,000 people were killed. Were executed, killed in cold blood, because the abbot, obviously doesn't make abbots look very good. The abbot said, "Kill them all. The Lord will recognize his own." So, from a Buddhist perspective, we would call this wrong view. But I recognize others might consider that to be a biased opinion. But to me, it's also. How, as the Buddha said in his own teachings, there's nothing more beneficial and helpful than right view, and there's nothing more destructive and nothing more harmful, nothing that's a greater cause of unwholesomeness than wrong view. And how the mind, based on a particular opinion or your own sense of rightness, your own particular conviction that your perspective is the true and correct perspective, that you can be so sure of that you are ready to have 20,000 people put to the sword, executed in cold blood. What it was like for the soldiers, I don't know, to actually had to do it, and the people who were on the receiving end, but they, according to the accounts, 20,000 people were massacred there in Béziers. So I feel that these kind of, when you're reading these histories, it really sort of hits you in the gut. And very poignantly, one of the local rulers was the Count of Toulouse. I think he was Raymond VI. I'm looking at Anagarika Didier to other French authorities. I think it was Raymond VI. Count of Toulouse, and he was a local ruler, and he was quite protective of the Cathar communities. And there's this very touching comment made by this historian. She said that Count Raymond made the most terrible mistake. He was guilty of the most awful sin, that of being a tolerant ruler. That was his big crime, was that he was tolerant, and so he was also given a very bad time by the church. But I feel these kind of stories and histories that were so sort of bloody and painful then. Also, they reflect upon our experience of these current times where still alive in the world today, you have that kind of religious certainty that can result in terrible destruction, cruelty, the destruction of human life, and the cause of great distress, social and physical distress for so many people in many regions of the world. It's a powerful reflection and encouragement towards the quality of tolerance, even though the historian was being sort of ironic and saying that Raymond was guilty of this terrible sin of being a tolerant ruler. You know, she's being ironic, because it's strange and mysterious how the act of being tolerant was of unacceptable, or that's what the authorities did not like and wouldn't approve of, and he was punished for. But I feel that one of the great blessings and gifts that comes through the Buddha's teachings, and what our practice of the Buddha's path can bring into our own lives, into the lives of the people that we live with, and into the greater world, is that very quality of tolerance, to be able to meet with that which we don't like, that which we don't agree with, that which is different from our own particular perceptions, our own views, our own conditioning, our own habits. And to be able to recognize how other people do things in different ways, they see things in different ways, and just because it's different from my way, why should that somehow be wrong? Why should that be considered as inferior or as incorrect? Obviously, there are issues about how people behave and the results of their actions. But just speaking about views, or about skin color, about religious beliefs, about nationality, I feel that the Buddha's teaching is a beautiful and wonderful example of how we can find ways to tolerate each other, to find a place of acceptance and respect. It's essentially establishing a heart which respects the lives of all living beings. It respects the lives of others, irrespective of the in terms of people, what their nationality might be, what their religious perspective might be, what their political views might be, what sort of place they have in society. It's a profound respectfulness for all others, and the more that we are able to understand that process of tolerance, of acceptance, then the more we are able to live harmoniously with others, and also we're able to fulfill the potential that we have as human beings within ourselves, because we learn to be accepting and tolerant of our own destructive or harmful or selfish obstructive habits. We see the dark side of our own nature, the unskillful sides of our own nature, and we learn to know that, to understand that, and to work with it. In saying these kind of things and saying it, being tolerant, it doesn't mean to say that we go along with every behavior, like to be tolerant of someone who is committed to murdering other people who don't have their same beliefs. It doesn't mean you're happy to let them keep murdering who they want to, or that being tolerant of your own angry impulses doesn't mean that you follow them. To be tolerant or to be accepting is not the same as to be approving. And those of you who listened to Lumpo Sumedho's Dhamma talks over the years or read his books, you'll have heard him say that over and over again, or read that in his teachings, that that acceptance is not the same as approval. So if I have tendencies towards greed or towards selfishness or towards anger, to be accepting of those tendencies doesn't mean that I act on every greedy impulse or I act on every selfish or angry impulse. It means that you're, say, using that aspect of your mind that can recognize anger is part of nature. Greed, lustfulness is part of nature. Jealousy or selfishness is part of nature. It's part of the natural order. And through recognizing that it is part of nature and reflecting on that, we also have the moral guidance, the guidance of the teachings towards what is skillful, what is unskillful, what brings benefit for ourselves and others. And so then recognizing that those qualities of our mind that are harmful or destructive or cause tension, stress, confusion, conflict between ourselves and others. You say, well, anger is part of nature, selfishness is part of nature, but if this is acted on, if this is followed, then I lose, you lose, everybody loses. So that's known, that's understood, that's recognized as being part of nature, but the mind chooses to respectfully lay it aside, gently and deliberately. We lay that aside. Similarly, if someone that we meet or someone that we're connected with, that their behavior is, destructive or creative of conflict, that is harmful to others and to themselves, then to be accepting of that doesn't mean that we try to make ourselves like it. You're not just trying to find a place where you say, oh, I'm so glad that this person is being violent or dishonest, or they are taking advantage of others. Oh, hooray, I'm so happy for you being a murderer or a bandit or a religious, destructive religious fanatic. I'm very happy for you. It's not creating that sort of false unrealistic positivity. We're not trying to make ourselves like the unlikable or pretend that the bitter is sweet. But to accept and to tolerate others means to recognize, well, that's the perspective that you have, or those are the habits that you have, and to the degree that you can offer feedback or say, I'm not going to hate you, but if I have an ability to have an effect on how things are done, then I will encourage you to stop acting in such a destructive way. I will happily stand up in court and say, I don't think this person should be free to roam the streets. That I saw them carry out a particular act. I have no hatred towards them, but this person's behavior is destructive, is hateful, is harmful. So I support them being being on the receiving end of appropriate justice. So it doesn't mean to say we would want everyone who behaves harmfully or destructively to be roaming the streets, but without negativity, without conflict, we can freely and totally in accordance with every ethic of kindness and compassion, say, I support this person being locked up for an appropriate period of time so they can reflect on their actions and learn how to live in a more harmonious and beneficial way. I feel this is helpful to get clear in our minds that we want to be disciples of the Buddha, to follow the Buddha's way, we should try to do that in a way that is wise and not foolish. And if we think that to have loving kindness means to say that you should love everybody and approve of what everybody is doing, or that you should say to be accepting or to be tolerant of everyone means that you just like a doormat, you just let people walk all over you, or you just let unskillful action be carried out without making any kind of input. That's a foolish grasping of the Buddha's teaching. It's not the Buddha's own way. You know, he was very active in terms of, say, establishing the precepts for the lay community, the 5 precepts, the 8 precepts. He spelt that out as codes of conduct of how to live skillfully. For the monastic order, he laid out thousands of rules, precepts, aspects of etiquette. We have a few hundred major precepts, but also if you add up all the minor aspects of etiquette and discipline, there's literally thousands and thousands of precepts, Sikkhapada, the training rules that the Buddha laid out. Do it like this, don't do it like that. And the structure of the Vinaya discipline is built around things that the monks or nuns did, that the Buddha said, you know, how can you, foolish man, act in such a way? You know, how can you, one of the monks who was the origin of numerous of our training rules, a monk called Udayin. He was trying to meditate, and there was a bunch of crows living in the trees near his kuti. So he was obviously quite a good shot with a bow and arrow. So he went out and shot these crows. And then another fellow monk walks by his kuti and says, "What are all these dead crows doing stuck up on the fence outside your kuti?" He says, "Oh, I shot them." "Well, why did you shoot them?" "Well, they're making such a racket, I couldn't meditate." So, of course, this, as it says over and over in the discipline, well, this matter was brought to the Lord, and the Lord said, "How can you, foolish man, deliberately take the life of living beings? This is not to be done." And then laying down a precept that a bhikkhu should not deliberately take the life of a living being. So that there's a lot of direction that the Buddha gives. Don't do it. It's not saying if you're being tolerant of the Venerable Udayan says, "Okay, well, if it makes you happy to kill the crows and it helps you with your meditation, that's all right." It's like, no, not to be done. Not out of hatred or aversion to Udayan or wanting to punish or just frustrate, but just laying out what is a skillful behavior. So when we talk about tolerance, being tolerant, it's not about being stupid. Being tolerant of our own weaknesses, or tolerant of our own unskillful habits, it does not mean to just follow them and to justify them in our minds, but rather it's to recognize, this is a tendency I have to tell lies, or to put myself first, or to get angry with people, or to tell backbiting stories about other people. Yeah, that's a tendency that might be there, but it's not something that's beneficial to myself or to others. Therefore, it's part of nature. It's a habit. It has its own particular force or strength that, having been followed so many times, but it's not something that has to be followed. And without negativity, without fear, or without aversion, it can be seen. It can be recognized, and the heart can choose to not follow it. So that we call this establishing a precept or establishing a practice. So tolerance doesn't mean being passive. tolerance means taking action and establishing an attitude that is in accordance with Dhamma, in accordance with reality, so that then the words that we speak or the actions that we take are going to be of benefit to ourselves, benefit to the people around us. We receive a lot of messages through the media, through the press, and the mind easily gets stirred up to form opinions about particular groups. We recognize our own preferences. I like group A, and I don't like group B. I'm for the reds, and I don't like the blues. Yeah, and the things that we read or the things that we hear easily supports that kind of polarity. Our own particular conditioning, our nationality, our gender, our place in society. So much of what we hear and read and is fed to us encourages that kind of identification with our nationality, our race, our gender, our position in society. And the mind creates fixed judgments. All men are like this, or all Americans are like that, or the monks are this way, or lay people are like that. And it's natural for us to have opinions. We have bodies, we have nationalities, we have our own personal stories, we have our language, we have our education, our conditioning of a whole lifetime. So it's completely normal and part of our lives to have a particular set of pattern, a particular kind of conditioning. But if we don't reflect upon and understand the influence that the media has, or the conversations of people around us, or the habits of our own conditioning, if we don't look at that and explore it and reflect on that, then we're always going to live in a world of division. If we want genuine tolerance, then a sense of living in accord with reality, living in harmony with nature, then it's essential that we understand how the mind makes those kind of polarities and judges this is good, that's bad, this is right, that's wrong. Yeah, and if we don't understand that, then we're always going to be experiencing a quality of alienation, of separateness, of loneliness, also the sense of isolation, a sort of me surrounded by that me. You know, I'm a man surrounded by other men on this side, or women on that side, or I'm British, or I'm English, and I'm not Scottish, or I'm not French, not American. So that I am this, and I'm surrounded by those who are not, and I belong to this team and the other lot, that team. If we are able to reflect on those particular ways of judging ourselves, judging others, and to see that these are just conventional ways of speaking, they're just convenient fictions, as I like to say, they're just easy ways of referring to some aspects of our experience. There's nothing absolute about them. There's nothing rigid or fixed. If we can understand how the mind creates those kind of judgments and divisions, then we'll find ourselves living in a much more peaceful world. Our own experience within our heart will be much more easeful. There'll be a quality of of, say, of wholeness and ease, peacefulness in our heart, rather than being, say, in a state of tension or conflict, separateness from so many around us. And one of the best ways that we have, the best kind of methods to explore and understand that conditioning is just to, essentially, just to watch our minds in the meditation, to see how the mind holds the memories of the day, the judgments we have about the people that we live with, how we call this person good or that person bad, how we approve of this one or we get irritated by that one, or we're afraid of this one and comforted by that one. To look, to say, oh, look at that. I'm upset by that person. I'm annoyed by that characteristic. I'm judging the monks are like this, or that, or the French are like that. The Americans are awful. And to see when the mind makes a judgment, and say characterizes others in a negative way, or ourselves, that we're critical of ourselves for being jealous or selfish or uneducated or weak or a failure, or somehow that I'm wrong or bad or incomplete or imperfect, just to apply right then and there, as in that moment, the reflection: is this true? Is what makes that true? I tell myself that I'm no good because of this characteristic. I'm no good because I'm badly educated, or I'm no good because I made this terrible mistake in my life. Yeah, or that person's really awful. I can't ever be happy if that person's around. Yeah, my life is ruined because I have to live with X or Y or Z. If only I didn't have this illness, or if only I didn't have this disability. If only I was younger. If only I was a woman. If only I was a man. If only I was a monk. If only I wasn't a monk. Then. And we torture ourselves. We make ourselves miserable and insecure through believing those kind of judgments. So if we wish to free the heart, if we wish to genuinely know peace, and genuinely know freedom, then one of the most effective and helpful tools is, as Ajahn Chah recommended, just to ask ourselves, is that so? When the mind makes a judgment, say, that's awful. Is that so? Oh, that's great. Is that so? I'm a mess. Is that so? That's unforgivable. Is that so? I can't bear it. Is that so? Yeah, she's really awful. Is that so? And it takes a kind of consistent mindfulness. You have to be quick on your feet to stick with the mind, because the mind moves very quickly. It creates perceptions and judgments really, really fast. So you have to be quick. You have to be alert to catch it, because it makes those kind of judgments and choices very, very quickly. But it's a very simple practice, but and Ajahn Chah was a genius at presenting teachings and practices in very accessible ways. But my experience of working with the mind like this, just to catch it when you notice the mind making a judgment about someone, this is really great. What I really want is X. If I have that, that'll be great. Is that so? What I really dread, what I really don't want to happen, is Y or Z. And if that happens, it'll be a disaster. Is that so? And if you catch it, it's like almost like sort of like snapping a picture. You catch it and then review that judgment. Just say, wait a minute, is that so? Why do I think that's true? Why do I tell myself it has to be that way? If I believe that, then I make it. I'm going to make it true. But why does that have to be a disaster? Why does this have to be something that's guaranteed to make me happy? Why am I saying that person is the cause of my misery? What makes that true? Is that so? And when that kind of simple, direct, reflective wisdom, it's a kind of yoniso manasikara or wise reflection, that kind of examination, wise reflection is brought to the mind's judgments, then we're in a way arousing the wisdom of our own heart. And that wisdom, at least in my experience, it almost every single time when I reflect in that way, when I think, well, what makes that true? Is that really so? Is that so? Then immediately the insight arises, the wisdom is right there. Like, no, it's not true. How could that be the whole story? Duh. You know, even if that would make you happy to get this desired object or to get away from that person that you disapprove of, does that mean you're going to be happy forever? Well, no. How could it be that way? It's ridiculous. And it hardly takes a moment. It's just if that clarity of seeing is applied, it hardly takes a moment for that wisdom to manifest, at least in my experience over many, many years of applying this practice in this kind of a way. So when we can hear these words, and maybe you're listening to what I'm saying, and maybe you, as you hear it, you go, yeah, right, that's a great idea. Yeah, I'll do that. And then it's great and it's true and valuable as you hear it in a Dhamma talk in the context of sitting quietly in the temple and listening and nothing else going on. But and that's great, you know, if you do hear these words and it makes sense and it seems meaningful and it is in accord with your own understanding, your own experience, great. But the value of a teaching is in its application. Just because it's true and valuable, if you don't take it with you, if you don't embody it, then it doesn't have a great value. Like a Buddha image is a symbol of that very wakeful, aware quality. Yeah. It's a symbol. So in a way, hearing the words that I'm saying and the mind going, yeah, right. It's like having a Buddha image that, yeah, right, that's beautiful, that's inspiring. But what's more important is having that Buddha wisdom active in your own heart. The rupa, the Buddha image, is there to help us to remember and to say arouse that awakened wisdom of our own heart. It's the Buddha image on its own doesn't have value. Its value is in the effect it has on our way of seeing, on our conduct, on our actions. That's its value. Yeah. Otherwise it's just a lump of metal. You know, it has a particular form. It's very well proportioned and graceful and beautifully made in its own way. But its value to us as human beings is that it can encourage the heart to awaken and to sustain that quality of wisdom. So in exactly the same way, these words or this idea of bringing that reflective wisdom to each moment to challenge our own judgments, our own, say, conflicts, our own habitual opinions and biases, it's valuable if you carry it with you. Just like if the Buddha image encourages you to be wise and awake, its purpose is fulfilled. So that to hear these words and to think, yeah, that's right, that's a good teaching, its value is actualized, is made real by applying it moment by moment to be ready to listen to those judgments, the liking this, disliking that, siding with this group and opposing that group. You know, this is good, that's bad. The Brexiters are bad, or the Remainers are good, or the Remainers are bad and the Brexiters are good. The yellow shirts are bad, the yellow shirts are good, the red shirts. Those who believe in climate change, those who don't believe in climate change. The women, the men, the old, the young. Whatever the mind chooses to fix upon and create ideas of like and dislike, approval, disapproval. Whatever the particular quality of distinction the mind fixates on, as soon as it makes a fixed by and absolute judgment, then there is alienation right there. There's a creation of self and other. There's the inner conflict, inner tension that arises from that. That's why in the Metta Sutta, that line, "Ditinja anupagamma sila," by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. By not holding to fixed views, it doesn't mean never perceiving anything, never giving rise to an opinion, but it's that very judgmental attitude, approving, disapproving, saying this is good, that is bad, this is right, that's wrong, and believing in those judgments as some kind of absolute truth. Buddhists are good, Muslims are bad, Christians are good, Buddhists are bad. These are the heretics, these are the faithful, these are the infidel, these are the saved. That if we take those to be true, if we have a fixed view, then suffering is created right there. If the mind recognizes this is a view, then the pure-hearted one there is a pure-heartedness, there is clarity of vision. The heart is not entangled in sense desires, is not woven into this particular sense object is good. This sound is good, that sound is bad. This taste is good, that taste is bad. This sight is beautiful, that sight is ugly. It's not buying into the value system of perceptions, but it knows this is a perception. Here is my mind saying this is beautiful. Here is the mind saying this is ugly. Here is the mind saying this is delicious. Here is the mind saying this is disgusting. Being freed from all sense desire, they are not born again into this world. So the being born means the mind attaching to the perceptions as solid and permanent realities. Not born again into this world is the heart awakening to the unborn, the undying, the unconditioned, the unformed. It's attuning to that already present quality of its own nature. It's not like you have to get the unborn or become the unborn or acquire it from somewhere else. But it's talking about an attribute of our own being that's already already existent, it's already present. Or when the heart frees itself from those fixed views, the views arise, but it knows, well, this is a view. Yeah. And it knows, well, yesterday I was calling this wrong, today I'm calling it right. Look at that, that's interesting. Or like when we're, an obvious example of when we're hungry. You know, you're hungry, you come into the sala, the nose smells the smells of freshly cooked food. Mmm, that smells good. Then when your stomach is full and you come into the sala and after the mealtime, you come into sala and you smell what technically would be the same smell, but then the perception is, oh, this place really stinks. Let's open some windows. This place needs airing out. What happened? The stomach was empty and there was a feeling of hunger and, smells good. And then the stomach is full, you've got all the food that you need. Ugh, this is disgusting. And then I know that the pedantic mind will say, oh, but Ajahn, the smell of fresh food is very, very different from the smell of food that's sort of been in the dish for a period of time. It's not the same smell. Well, the pedantic can debate that as long as you wish. But it's helpful to look at these simple examples, how in, say, when you can't be bothered to park your car tidily, it's quite okay to just park across the line between two parking spaces. Well, there's lots of empty spaces, it's not really taking up much room, and there's no need to bother. Because it's you at that point. Then you come into a car park and somebody else has parked across the dividing line between two spaces. I can't believe how people park like this. This is so untidy. Don't people know how to park properly? Because it's them. And the perennial example of how with our dear M25, the motorway going all the way around London, how the car that I am in is never traffic. They are traffic. When you look at your little Google Maps and you see the thick red dots, you go, oh no, there's lots of traffic here. You never think, oh dear, I'm being traffic, clogging up the roads for all these good people who have important places to get to. I mean, I say this over and over again, but it's interesting how we keep forgetting and how over and over again we're on the M25. Oh no, look at the traffic. We are traffic. We can. Why do we call them traffic and me on my way to Chithurst or me on my way to the airport? Why is that smell good? Why do we call it good when we're hungry and disgusting, off-putting when we're full? Is it a good smell or is it a bad smell? Where does that goodness and badness come from? It's solely the judgment of the mind. So if there's wisdom, we'll recognize, oh, look, now it calls it good. Now it calls it bad. Aha, look at that. And in that moment, the heart has freed itself from birth and death. It's not born into the smell. Being freed from birth and death can sound like a very kind of grand, spectacular sort of colorful event, off somewhere else in some different dimension, way in the future. But I would say that more really and more realistically, more tangibly, freedom from birth and death is just in that moment where the mind recognizes, oh, this is approving of a smell. This is saying, I like it. That's all. This is the mind saying, I don't like it. That's all. It's just a judgment is arising and passing away. That which knows the judgment is not judging. That which knows an opinion is not opinionated. That which knows the feeling of failure and the bitterness of loss hasn't lost anything. That which knows the sweetness of success, the pleasure of gaining, hasn't gained anything. It knows, it's awake. That's all. Can't lose anything, can't gain anything. Yeah. It's the awake mind knowing the reality of the way things are. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening, and if I've offended any Bible-believing Catholics, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, humanists, then I ask for forgiveness. But I offer these reflections with the intention of, furthering the quality of human well-being and the quality of understanding, and with the intention of bringing benefit, not to single out any particular group or find fault, but to point to what it is that frees the heart, and what brings genuine well-being, and what obstructs it. Ewang.